From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Emily is kind of shambolic, funny character in my memory of the
story. How dare you call her shambolic? She's trying her best, God love her.
So what they're trying to do then is measure the likelihood of committing future offences. This is future crime, essentially.
Yes.
You know, people mean well, but I don't particularly like that photograph now. I'm like, do I look like that on my wedding day?
Coming up on this Can This Really Be Summer? Edition of Playback Daily, Burn After Reading, Catherine Ryan Howard on her new thriller. Minority Report, the future of crime detection is near. And the hidden and not so hidden effects of endometriosis. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that has detected a crime against comedy in next week's Playback Daily. We'll start where we usually do with the monologue from this morning's Oliver Callan. And today Oliver started, where else, with the Orange One's big climb down.
Now, who had it in the crystal ball that Mr. Trump would blink, balk, roll back, surrender, half withdrawing from the trade war, Cogu Trodola, as we learned here, Australia, but escalating it with China? Basically, reality kind of come crashing in this fantasy that he could let the market or roam free from regulations at home, but impose all of these kind of greasy barriers internationally and then expect it all somehow to work. But the stock market, the bond markets and the broligarchy likely caused him to second guess. And despite that big bullish speech we were talking about only this time yesterday morning, the Tuesday night speech, he's in his black tie going, he will never surrender. And Wednesday lunchtime, it was all over. And that meant that those worldwide tariffs of more than 10% imposed in 60 countries, including our own and the EU at 25%, they only lasted a couple of hours in the end. April 9th was both Liberation Day and Capitulation Day. The good news for us here, of course, is that the island of Ireland is once again economically united on the same tariffs, because that was the worry, wasn't it? We had 25% down here, 10% up north. But it's so good news is the partitioning economically for a few hours is over. The bad news is we still have tariffs of 10%, which is no crack at all. But the trade war is now very clearly America versus China. And 125% tariff on Chinese goods, that's going to hit China very hard because they run a big surplus with America exporting hundreds of billions more than they import from the US. A Tonka toy truck, which was $30 a few months ago, would now technically cost, someone do the calculation for me there. Oh no, I really should have planned this. $60 would be the 100% and then a quarter of that, much more, much more. I had one of those as a kid and I've looked it up because it was one of the things they mentioned early on in February when the tariff talk began. They sell something like 20 million of those yellow Tonka toy trucks to American consumers and they go all around the world. But of course, inside America, the cost of goods will also hit the consumers of all hues everywhere because of the amount of things they import from China and even just the parts to make stuff they make in America coming from China. The biggest casualty there is reading is the US farmers, the agri sector, whose soybeans and their corn and their cotton and everything else go bigly to China, but they are predominantly Republicans too, so they're going to be unhappy. So the trade war continues, but his negotiating position is so weak now. I mean, he can hardly threaten to return to those big sweeping tariffs because they've been quite literally shown to spectacularly fail, spooking the bond markets, which would make it too expensive for the Americans to borrow. So that gun on the table turned out to be a banana. And by the cut of him, he doesn't eat fruit or vegetables. Yippee, I think is the word of the day, because he said everybody got a bit yippee. That's why he had to, you know, do the big U-turn. It wasn't his fault at all. It was the chaotic, like, it is not his fault, to be fair, that his chaotic made-up tariffs that were based on 3 o'clock in the morning, fried chicken night terrors, it's not his that they were causing the start of a global recession. No, it's the market's fault for getting queasy and scared and frightened. Overnight, as you'd expect, the late night shows on American telly have been enjoying this first of the major climb downs. How many days in office? Not 100 anyway, not even close. The Democrats might be dead, but there is one mighty opposition movement in America that is facing Trump, and that opposition movement is his own ideas. Here's Desi Leidick of The Daily Show.
I don't understand what happened here. You tanked global stock markets. You put us on the verge of a recession. You told everyone to build factories in America because the tariffs wouldn't go away. And then you took them away. What happened? Did you just get spooked by the markets?
It's the master of the deal.
I mean, you're watching the art of the deal in real time here.
Many of you in the media clearly missed the art of the deal.
Yes, the art of of the deal. Create a global crisis and then dig yourself halfway out. It's truly masterful. Come on, Trump. Just admit that you started a game of chicken and you got too scared to finish it.
Well, I thought that people were jumping a little bit out of line. They were getting yippy, you know? They were getting a little bit yippy, a little bit afraid.
Oh. We got too scared. Sorry. I tend to get a little yippy when my retirement plan starts to look like the elevator from The Shining.
What an image. And so the BBC have it this morning in their more po-faced language. The reordering of the global economic order is on hold and Trump's promise of a golden age of American manufacturing will have to wait. They also say it didn't take long for Trump's aides, many of the same people who said he would never back down, only hours before they fanned out celebrating the president's move. In fact, I was watching Fox News live last night. I put on the internet and Trump was there announcing his U-turn. He'd already announced it on his Truth Social platform online, and this was his first time meeting the press in a huddle, and he was very glum, very downbeat press huddle. He was surrounded by NASCAR drivers because he was holding an event with them. Everyone behind him looked really sad and uncertain while standing in front of these very silly looking cars that had like the brands of all the corporations who were probably phoning him nonstop for the last couple of days. And then Fox cut straight to a Ronald Reagan era advisor who said, I was wondering, how are they going to spin this one? He's totally climbed down. He looks sad and miserable. And the guy was going, wow, what an amazing guy. I'm such a coward. I would never do what Trump did. He's so brave, the way he plucked a figure out of his ear holes and smacked the markets upside its head and just saying, now we can roam free. Now all these terrible barriers that somebody put up are gone, and was very excited about the future. The anti-Trump media are having an absolute field day. Here's more late night. Jimmy Fallon, Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Kimmel.
Well, with the tariffs paused, the U.S. now has 3 months to work out all of its relationships with all these countries. Basically, our economy now mimics the exact plot of 90 Day Fiancé. Think about it. It's the same thing.
Thank goodness that at 1:18 p.m. today, Donald Trump made a decision that at the last minute saved our nation from a previous decision by Donald Trump. I mean, thank God.
I mean, wow.
Thank God he is there to stop him.
Well, I thought that people were jumping a little bit out of line. They were getting yippy, you know? They were getting a little bit yippy.
Yeah, exactly. Russia was watching Trump tank the economy and going, yippee! Yippee!
Wow. Trump said that he paused tariffs because people were getting yippy and queasy. Then Trump tried naming the other seven dwarves.
It was yippy, queasy, greasy.
Yippy and queasy were also the seating sections at Trump's wedding. Hi. I'm in the queasy section.
U.S. late night talk show host Jimmy Fallon there on the tariff climb down, as brought to us by Oliver during his monologue this morning. That was the reaction in the US, but what about closer to home? Oliver reached for the papers.
The Irish Star has the best headline of the day. The arse of the deal is their headline there. The Daily Telegraph, Trump blinks first in trade war. So kind of the more somber things, whereas in Ireland it's like Great War of China, Irish Daily Mirror. And Trump does a tariff Donald Duck. 90-day pause, but not for China, and that is the Irish Sun this morning. And then you go to The Guardian. Trump pauses global trade war, but hits China with 125% tariffs. So all taking it very kind of... You wonder, how is the pro-Trump media covering all of this story? Well, on Fox News Online this morning, a bit of kind of distraction, obfuscation going on. Somehow, this 90-day pause to early July of tariffs is not the lead story like it is everywhere else on the planet. House passes bill to stop rogue judges blocking President Trump's agenda. So that's a story celebrating his attempts to take on the separation of powers there. That's just nothing to see there. And down below, they have tariff twist, they're calling it. Trump says he'd take a look at exempting some larger American companies. Yeah, covered that. And Trump's tariff pause is an example of his pragmatism. It's an interesting one. And then along the other distractions, US warships are getting a new route as China loses its grip on the Panama Canal. So it's all his success. Michelle Obama addresses divorce rumours after skipping recent high-profile events. And that's a story Fox is kind of obsessed with. And Michelle Obama was on a podcast. What's she saying? She's basically saying that that she couldn't fathom that she said people couldn't fathom that she was making a choice for herself by going to things on her own or maybe not going to events that her husband was, that they just assumed that my husband and I are divorcing. But you know what? This couldn't be a grown woman just making a set of decisions on her own. That's what society does to us. And she obviously has dismissed all of that speculation. So there you go.
And as so many, especially older people, get their news from Fox News in the US, you can maybe at least partly see why they make the choices that they make. I mean, naked self-interest, racism, misogyny and hatred of anything or anyone different also comes into it, obviously. But hey, get a second news opinion, people. Anywho, let's not so gracefully exit our extract from the Oliver Callan morning monologue right there. Independent TD Michael Fitzmaurice has proposed cutting down all trees within 30 metres of a road or a power line. The controversial proposal comes in the wake of Storm Eowyn, when many thousands of people were left without power when trees fell on power lines. But critics of the proposal say that cutting down so many trees would have consequences for Ireland's dwindling biodiversity. This morning, Claire Byrne spoke to environmentalist, researcher and contributor to the Irish Times, Sive O'Neill, as well as to Michael Fitzmaurice himself.
First of all, let me be very clear, I am talking about trees, not hedgerows. Second of all, we have seen in the recent storm probably well over $1 billion in damage for the different sectors. Through forestry, first of all, let's deal with the different things. Through forestry, where power lines have gone through, it's clear for the different types of power lines, you have a 5, 10 and 15 metre basically width from the trees. But what people need to understand is that is overall. So if there's two wires, if it's 10 metres, it's 5 metres each side. We have seen the devastation that has been caused right around the west of Ireland and parts of the Midlands after the storm because of what happened with trees. Second of all, and we ordinary people, communities went out after the storm, and it was trees, singular trees everywhere that caused problems right along the highways and the byways in rural Ireland that had to be shifted. And we have spent, or are going spending $5 billion on broadband in the west of Ireland. It has decimated. There are people today still without a phone line that need their panic alarm button. What's the reason? Unfortunately, because of trees that have fell. And we have to, and by the way, I have made it very clear as well that if you cut a tree, that you would sow two trees in replacement for it. And, you know, people will say, well, Michael, what's a white thorn? We call it laying or a white thorn hedge. We are fully for making sure that hedgerows are protected. Right. This is not about getting rid of trees.
But Michael,
this is about making sure we have trees in the proper places that do not affect people.
Okay, but if you're saying that all trees within 30 metres be cut down, people might say that that is just a step too far.
Let me be very clear. When you prepare legislation, you can define what you are talking about. And my definition would be that in the line of a hedgerow is up to 2.5 metres high generally everywhere. A hedgerow can be, each year, you can make sure that it's basically pruned or that you can look after, that it's not getting out of control on you. Fully for that. You can put that into legislation. You can legislate what you define as trees. I'm talking about, right, Claire, I'll give you an example. And I sent it to your producer this morning. A tree on the side of the road that had ashed out by, a waiting bomb for someone. Unfortunately, we have lost a life in the last storm. We need to make sure that we take preventative measures that people are not killed on roads. And we are sitting on a ticking time bomb.
Okay,
that's
well,
what we are doing
at the
moment.
Let's bring in Sive O'Neill on this. I mean, in the context of what we saw during Storm Eowyn and the aftermath, Sive, does that proposal not make sense?
Well, dangerous trees on roadside locations should be removed. There's no question about that. I was up in the west of Ireland myself after the storm, and it was like a bomb had gone off. It was extraordinary, the damage that was done, trees and branches falling everywhere, and further trees that were clearly a threat because they were kind of leaning over the road. And landowners are taking responsible action when they remove them. There's no requirement for a felling licence in those instances. I think that the conversation is a timely one because we need to be thinking about how to protect and restore our hedgerows. The trees that we're talking about are largely in hedgerows, and when hedgerows aren't maintained properly and they have fallen into decline all over the country, very often the trees escape. You know, trees that would have been cut are growing up into much taller shrubs and potentially posing a risk. The other thing is we are kind of forgetting sometimes that trees naturally age and die. And as they get older, there's a higher risk that they will come down in a storm. So it's something that landowners are going to have to and do generally keep an eye on all the time. But as a policy, I think it would be much more appropriate to have this issue teased out properly at the Agricultural Committee and the Oireachtas, which would be able to hear from the experts in Hedgerows Ireland, hear from the farming organisations and hear from the Forest Service. There are lots of different issues here because, for example, a lot of the lines that came down were in forest plantations, which we know have different issues associated with them than hedgerows on the side of a public road.
So in principle, are you saying that you're not against cutting down trees within 30 metres of power lines or roads?
It's not a question of my opinion at all. It's perfectly legal to remove, and it's a requirement really to remove a dangerous tree on the side of a road. But I think if I understand him correctly, Michael is proposing that all trees should be removed, and I think that's excessive. I think that would not meet any kind of scientific standard.
Well, that's it, isn't it, Michael? All trees within 30 metres of a road or a power line. So we're not just talking...
The first thing we need to know is what's your definition of a tree? You can sow a beech plantain and you can have it as a hedgerow. You can sow Leylandii. If you let that go out of control, as Saif has said, it grows up to be a tree. So what we need to make sure is that we have legislation that controls the height that we could go. If you have a hedgerow, that's not going to basically come out on the road. And in fairness, even if it did, it's not going to kill somebody. What I am talking about is trees, all different variety of trees, that are growing 10, 15, 20, 25, up to 30 metres high, is what I am talking about. I am all for making sure that... I'll give you the example. In rural Ireland, we have a lot of whitethorn. And you lay them and you make a thicker hedgerow right along. That is the way to do that. You don't have to be cutting them out of phase. What I am talking about is large trees that are near, over 2.5 metres, to put it simple, if you want to call it, and higher, that has the potential to take out power lines or has the potential to go out on a road and cause death. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about.
I think that would be devastating for biodiversity. If you're hearing birdsong these days on the beautiful sunny mornings, it's because it's bird nesting season. And where do birds nest? They nest in trees. And the reality is that hedgerows in which these trees that Michael is talking about are growing are the last remaining vestiges of biodiversity in our rural landscape. And it's in decline. We estimate that we're losing about 1% of the hedgerows per annum. There's a lot of illegal removal, and that the practices have basically fallen into decline. The practices of coppicing and laying that Michael referred to there are not generally being deployed. What we're seeing is tractors coming out in the wintertime with flails that are cutting the hedges down so low that it's not possible for them to produce flowers, nuts and berries in the autumn. And very often the flailing is actually happening too early in the autumn so that birds and mammals aren't getting a chance to actually feed on the fruit. So we need hedgerows. We need more hedgerows. We need plans for this. Now, I think it's a misnomer to talk about trees without considering the hedgerows in which they are actually growing, because it's all the same. It's all part of the rural landscape.
Sive O'Neill, environmentalist, researcher and contributor to the Irish Times, debating cutting down roadside trees with independent TD Michael Fitzmaurice on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. Ray Darcy show regular Jennifer Rock, aka the Skin Nerd, joined Ray in studio this afternoon to talk about herself and her health.
Throughout my 20s then, I had been diagnosed with endometriosis. So essentially it's a condition that affects 1 in 10 women. So it's quite a common condition, but it can go undiagnosed for a very long period of time because there's no test or blood test for it. It has to be, you have to have what's called a laparoscopy or keyhole surgery for the doctor to say you do have this condition.
And what are the symptoms of?
It can vary for people. I suppose this is my opinion as opposed to speaking from a medic's perspective.
Course,
yeah. So it can be really irregular periods, very heavy periods. It can be issues with your bowels and other organs within the pelvic floor, so or the pelvic region. So for me, it was all of those things. And it was just, it was, and because, lifestyle's hugely affected by it, I suppose.
Because, Jennifer, you had Matthew at 18 and you were in touch with a gynecologist, dealing with a gynecologist. You got your diagnosis young then, did you? Right.
Yeah. And this, sorry.
Go on,
So I suppose for me, I was told that the endometriosis was removed. And in my ignorance and my complete youth, I suppose I just didn't look into it any further. Uh-huh. And I was fine for a good few years because I'd had the operation, had had cysts and fibroids removed, and just thought, well, they're removed, so endometriosis was removed too. But unfortunately, the reality with endometriosis is that it's a lifelong condition. So it does repeat and does reoccur. So a couple of years later then, I suppose it would have ended up in the same, back to what you asked me, what were those symptoms? They started reoccurring. So hospital trips and very heavy bleeding and collapsing with it, or just like, like an awful lot of agony and pain, if I'm being honest, without, you know, feeling sorry for yourself. But that's the truth of what so many women will go through, and just suffer in silence and say, well, you know, it's fine, keep going. Just a few more days to get through this period of my period.
So you got a diagnosis young.
Yes.
Thought it was sorted. So when the same things recurred, what did you think it was?
It's a great question. I didn't really place it back to endometriosis. I knew it was to do with what I perhaps had experienced in the past, but thought, here I go again. So it was back under the care of various different doctors. But I think the hard part, and what I have found through speaking with this so openly over the last few weeks and months, is many women have suffered the same, in that you're fearful that you're imagining yourself. You're saying, look, every woman in the world has a period, so let's just keep going with it. It's fine. Just get to Friday. That's day 5. It'll be less by then. And just plough on through, as I think we tend to do as a nation, just keep rallying on. But I suppose then it started to become apparent that the cysts were back, the fibroids were back, as they tend to reoccur for people, and the endometriosis was back. Yeah. So it was just managing that.
And I suppose it's still a taboo subject, isn't it?
Yeah,
a woman's period. I really can't understand why it is.
Well, I often say most of us wouldn't be here without a period or fertility. It's all related to I suppose, a woman's cycle. And as I mentioned, having Matthew, I mean, this has been my reality since he's been born. So he probably knows more about the female anatomy and the cycle of a woman's menstrual period than many men younger than him or older than him. And I think that's important, that, you know, whomever he ends up in a relationship or whomever he works with, he's always going to be surrounded by women. So to understand that this is what we all go through, be it a normal period or a non-normal period, it really is something to just accept as part and parcel of a woman's life. And how can you support them during it? Because I think the part that I have found is that it's the hormonal element that isn't discussed. We talk about the bleeding, but maybe not the hormonal piece. And it really does affect people so much more than I've even experienced. So again, allowing that to be something that a woman can say in her WhatsApp group to her friends, you know, over a coffee, is this your norm? What do you experience? Well, that's not mine. Or, and then maybe encouraging that conversation then to take it to, well, I need to talk to my doctor about this, or I need to speak to a medic about this, because this isn't okay, because it doesn't seem to be the norm.
And if you're keeping a lid on it, if you're keeping quiet about it, then you think that what you're going through could be normal when it may not be.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So I suppose then in my 30s, my later 30s, it became just honestly, truly unbearable, to the point that last year there was no other option, not because the endometriosis, that was going to be managed through operations and so on, but the hysterectomy was something that I was advised to have had and then ultimately wasn't given a choice because of the fibroids and their positioning. So I suppose at 38, 39...
So there's 39, two things going on.
It's a beautiful little myriad of medical realities, as is all often the case. All down there. But yeah, so there was a couple of things going on that kind of added the complexities. And then last year, I had an amazing gynecologist, and Niamh just said to me, Jen, there's no choice anymore. You can't, like, do you want to live like this every day? And my answer was, and I think I'm quite a positive, energetic, sprightly, plough on through type person, resilient, but no one deserves to live like what last year was for me. And again, then when I had the hysterectomy, I suppose I've had so many women say, that's just not spoken about. And hundreds of people saying, I've had it, or my friends had it, or my sister, or my mom had it. And just again, normalizing it. That
so that's a removal of the womb.
Yeah, removal of the womb, exactly. And in my case, I had fallopian tubes removed and the cervix. So it can be case by case, depending on what part
of the organ you remove.
I chose to keep my ovaries in, although the endometriosis was quite significant, because I didn't want to have to go into, you know, overnight menopause. I'd already been medically induced into menopause for a couple of months to keep all of the, I suppose, pain I'd had at
bay. Oh, that's to prepare you for the operation? Or?
Yeah, essentially just keeps the, from my understanding of it, is that it kept the fibroid at bay. So the fibroid itself was about 12 centimetres at this stage. So it had grown, I had had treatment to shrink it, and it had grown like 8 centimetres in 3 months. And you'd walk around, and we got married last year, which was an amazing moment. And then, you know, somebody said to me on the wedding day, like, are you pregnant? And I was like, oh no, just my fibroid is really large today. So I'd effectively look like a, I suppose, an early pregnancy person, because the fibroid was so large alongside the cyst and whatever.
And they asked you, did they?
In the kindest way, because I think that, you know, people mean well.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't particularly like that photograph now. I'm like, do I look like that on my wedding day? But no, look, the serious side of us is that it actually brought up an awful lot of conversations at home about, did we want to continue a family? Because obviously, if your womb's removed, from a female perspective, I can no longer carry.
Now, there's loads of things going on in your life. So we've sort of, that's one aspect of it, the endometriosis. Your sexuality is another one. Being a very young parent is another one. So I suppose let's go back again then to being a young parent, and we'll bring them all together at the end. So you were sitting your leave insert.
Yes.
And you got pregnant.
Yes. To be honest with you, Ray, and Matthew knows this, when Matthew turned 18 a couple of years ago, I remember being quite upset in the moment, because I looked at him at 18 and I love him, but I've spoiled that man. And so could he boil an egg? Just about. So I was looking at the sheer innocence of him, thinking, God, that was what people around me saw at that time. You know, an eager and ambitious child. So although on paper an adult, potentially not a full adult.
Yes, yeah.
And so being aware that this person, myself, was now very responsible for another person, I think I definitely saw it later in my life. Whereas
yes.
At the time, I was like, we're just going to keep going. But I was a child having a child.
That's Jennifer Rock, also known as the Skin Nerd, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon about her endometriosis, among other health-related issues. Ten years ago, Catherine Ryan Howard signed her first book deal. And to celebrate that anniversary, she's gone and written another book, her eighth. And she joined Oliver Callan in studio to talk about the new book, Burn After Reading, and her amazing 10 years of being a best-selling author.
In this one, a writer who has had a really successful first novel and then has a terrible bout of difficult second album syndrome and hasn't written another word since. Her publisher comes looking for their money back and they say, actually, you know, there's a mutually beneficial solution here. We have a ghostwriting job. And she takes it out of desperation, and it's helping a man who most people believe has killed his wife to tell his side of the story, which he says is that he's innocent.
He's basically the most hated man in Ireland in this story.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
fair enough.
She's a celebrated literary figure who's decided. Yeah.
Well, she was. It's been a couple of years and now everyone has forgotten she even wrote a book. And there's a scene where, I mean, I wonder where I got this from. You know, she goes into a bookshop, and what happens is, you know, when you have a book out and you go book shopping, you know, they recognise you and they say hi. And then, you know, it's been a long time since the book came out, when you're just treated like any other customer, or sometimes asked where the toilets are. So, you know. There's a lot of publishing stuff in this book, which I really enjoy.
Yeah. She goes to meetings with some people who don't come across very well.
Yeah, yeah. No reflection of any publisher of mine who are amazing.
I know. Maybe a previous one. Have you been with the same people all the time?
No, I haven't. Move on.
You always leave a little bit on the table somewhere. I read it actually around Christmas time. I read this actually, and I was Emily is kind of shambolic, funny character in my memory of the story.
How dare you call her shambolic? She's trying her best, God love her. She is trying her
best.
A mess. It's a hard job. It's
she's
a hard
mess,
job
though, in a very funny way.
Yeah, yeah, she is. She's kind of her own worst enemy, I think, you know, that she doesn't make, like, it always makes me laugh when readers say, you know, especially in crime and thriller, the character is very unlikable and like she did this silly thing and why did she make that decision? Crime novels are not born out of good decisions. Like, yes. People have to be a bit, you know, they have to make a couple of mistakes or there is no drama.
But it's very nice to follow her because we kind of feel her paranoia starting to grip and looking around as she's traveling.
I hope so.
Who's this one? O.J. Simpson looms large over this story.
Yeah, I don't want to say that this was inspired by O.J. Simpson because, first of all, you know, when you get into the book, it's nothing to do with that case. No. And also inspired is a positive word, which I don't like associating with him. But in 2004, he did something inexplicable, which is that he signed a book deal to tell, like, the point of the book was that he would confess, but hypothetically. So it would be the story of what happened that night if he had killed the two people, but he didn't, wink, wink. Just completely insane. Yeah. The book was ultimately cancelled, and then the Goldman family, who had already won a civil judgment against him and were owed money, fought for the rights and they published it. I think their attitude was, this is a guilty man showing the world that he's guilty, so let's let him do it. And the only difference they made to the book is they took the "if" in the title.
It was
and
"If
made
I Did
If
It".
"If I Did It".
It was his proposed title.
That was the title.
"If I Did It".
And they
Here's
shrunk Harold. The "if" on the cover. So when you look at it, it looks like it's called "I Did It".
I did it.
And it reads that way too, let me tell
And the
you.
Fascinating thing for you is that this was ghostwritten.
Yeah, so there's an amazing documentary that's absolutely worth the 7-hour commitment. OJ,
really?
Oscar-winning O.J. Made in America. And in the very last part, there's a brief interview with Pablo Fuentes, who was the ghostwriter. Mm. Now, speaking of, like, stranger than fiction, he was actually a witness for the prosecution. He lived near Nicole Brown and heard her dog wailing at a crucial time.
I didn't know that.
He had testified at the trial. If I tried to put that in a novel, I'd be laughed out of the place. And totally coincidentally then got the job as his ghostwriter. And I just couldn't get the image out of my head of these two men in a room and, you know, they both know what really happened. And OJ presumably is going through the motions of, like, pretending it's all fiction. And Fuentes describes a moment where he kind of slipped out of the conditional tense and instead of saying, you know, and then I might have gone this way, or he said, and then I went and then I turned. And there was like a sort of pregnant pause. And as a thriller writer, I just kept thinking about that moment. And I thought, you know, a ghostwriter locked in a room with a man who maybe committed murder. But what if his guilt wasn't so cut and dry? What if she was an experience? What if she was a woman? I want to go back to this place I love to go on holidays, so I will put it in a book so I can expense it. And that's how we get to Burn After Reading.
That's why you're in Florida.
Which came interest. First, Florida or the idea? We'll never know. We'll never know.
Did you go down to Florida then to spend a lot of time this time? Because you lived there once upon a time.
Once upon a time, a very long time ago. But I lived in Orlando because I was working in Walt Disney World. So this area is up in the Panhandle. And actually, the last time I was here, I had just got my driver's license a week before.
That's right.
And 8 weeks later, I flew to this tiny airport called Fort Walton Beach. And I rented a car all by myself, which turned out to be a Toyota Camry, which is twice the width and twice the length of the car I actually drive. Had to get into it by myself, wrong side of the road, highway. It was like that scene from Clueless, but I made it. And that's where I was. I was in this town and this area in the Panhandle.
That's what you were doing that time. I feel like I lied to in the past that you weren't able to tell us that's what you were planning. You'd be driving a week or something at that point, August 2023.
So I would have had my license 8 weeks. And I actually, like, when I got out, that's the most terrifying thing I ever did, was picking up that car. When I got out of it, my knees were like jelly and my hands were shaking. But I said, the best thing to do is get straight back into the car. And 24 hours later, she's cruising down the highway. Taylor Swift is blasting, coffee in one hand on the wheel. And I actually ended up driving from there to Orlando, which is 7 hours each way.
Wow.
So the following week, I was basically cocky about the driving. Didn't tell my mom until the car was back at the rental agency and I was on the plane.
Did you bring your little Our Lady of Lourdes water with you?
No, sure, she didn't know what I was doing. So, but I'd say if I had told her, the novenas would have been going. Yeah.
So you go down and ride. It's set in the Keys, isn't it? It's set down the Florida Keys.
No, the Panhandle is like, if you imagine Florida as a kind of long.
Yeah. Yeah.
Difficult state. We won't get into their politics, but
did it feel a bit MAGA when you were there, by the way?
So the first time I went to Seaside, that was actually my second time going. The first time I didn't drive, couldn't drive, so I had to get a driver, and he picked me up at the airport, and it's about 40 minutes to where I was going, and then once I was there I wouldn't need a car. But for the full 40 minutes, I was listening to how amazing Trump is, and I was hearing in great detail stories about this man's gun collection. This is a driver, like a professional service, and he was trying to convince me that, you know, he's a collector. And I said, I understand that, but why do you need the bullets?
Yeah.
If it's the guns that you like, why do you need the
They want
bullets?
To fire them is the thing. Was that completely different to nearly 20 years, I'd say, is it, since you were working?
Yeah, we don't need to tell everyone how long ago.
Was it different when
you
were working
Orlando
there?
Orlando is like a ring-fenced area of, you know, progression and liberalism in the middle of a state that is red and southern and, you know, absolutely trumped.
Beautiful place though, isn't it? Really nice.
It does have some lovely beaches and, you know, I do like Disney and stuff. So, but I don't know. It is weird when you're driving down the highway. I'm just obsessed with the fact that I drove by myself on the highway. And you're seeing, you know, advertisements about abortion and things like that. It's a very odd juxtaposition that you have this incredibly, you know, fun and happy and amazing and progressive pocket in Orlando, and it's surrounded nearly on all sides by.
Mind you, if you go down to Miami and so on, it's very multicultural. It it feels like you're not in America
like Miami
at all.
And
like
Orlando would be, you know, I safe enough to go.
They voted for Trump. There you go, a bit of balance.
Author Catherine Ryan Howard talking to Oliver Callan this morning about her new thriller and her 10 years writing. Burn After Reading is published by Bantam. Can you guess what film inspired the scheme that was originally called
The Homicide Prediction Project?
The scheme is the brainchild of author Philip K. Dick and was memorably featured in the Steven Spielberg film Minority Report. Remarkably, in real life, it's a plan that the British Ministry of Justice have underway. This morning, Claire Byrne spoke to Chris Jones, executive director of State Watch, the organisation that discovered the existence of the pre-crime programme, about this AI-infused project that aims to predict who will commit violent crimes and even murder in the future.
Tell us how you discovered this and what is it?
Yeah, it's a Ministry of Justice research project. Two colleagues of mine have been doing research on automated and algorithmic decision makings for police and criminal justice purposes. And this is one of the projects they came across. They filed some freedom of information requests with the Ministry of Justice, and they released the documents that you can find on our website that are the basis for this story.
So tell us what type of information then is being handled and how is it being put together? How is it being gathered?
Yeah, I mean, from what we know, most of the data for this project came from the Greater Manchester Police, so one of the largest police forces in the UK, and the Ministry of Justice. And they gathered a large amount of data from the Greater Manchester Police on people who were in the forces system. So the Ministry of Justice has said the data that's been used only relates to people who have been convicted of an offence. Their own data sharing agreement shows otherwise. So there's people who are victims, witnesses, suspects, all manner of stuff. So it seems very broad, the amount of information they're gathering in the first place to try and produce these so-called predictions.
Okay, so what they're trying to do then is measure the likelihood of committing future offences. This is future crime, essentially.
Yes. I mean, what the documents say is that, you know, they want to work out from this data whether there is a way to, you know, find predictors or predictions for people who will commit violent offences such as murder in the future by combing through this data with various algorithms and, you know, data science techniques.
Okay, so you found then the data, as you mentioned there, from people who are not convicted of any criminal offence was also used. Did the officials involved deny that that was the case, Chris?
What they say is that the final cohort of people concerned by the research project will only be those with convictions, which, you know, why then do you need to collect all this data on, you know, tens of thousands of other people who have committed no offence? I mean, amongst that as well, there's data on, you know, very sensitive matters like people's mental health, whether they have some kind of addiction and so on and so on. And fundamentally, you know, regardless of the sort of privacy and data protection aspects of this, the more fundamental point is really, do we need or want systems like this? You know, I think many people can see that we have a lot of deep-rooted problems in our society, and I don't think they're going to be solved by sort of techno solutions like this. There's far more fundamental problems and sort of far more fundamental re-examination of these issues we need to look at. Where are the social services? You know, where's the care and support for people who need it when they're in crisis? Mm-hmm. You know, governments have stripped that away over the last 15 years, and this is not going to solve that.
Well, another interesting question is, what do they do with the information? So if their algorithm makes a prediction that I'm going to commit a serious crime, what do they do?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, we haven't got to that stage yet, thankfully. So what they have been doing is researching this to see whether it could be, you know, put into practice, to see whether it could be operationalized in their terms in the future. So what they would do, we don't know. But you can assume that, you know, there's other examples of systems like this from other countries in Europe, from within the UK. There's a very widely used system in the prison system, which is used to assess prisoners' risks of reoffending, or their supposed risks of reoffending. And that can affect, you know, whether you get to go on parole, the conditions you're kept in, your access to services within prison, and, you know, your future life chances, basically. So there's many other examples, also from other countries, from France, from Belgium, where, you know, these things have very negative effects for people based on, you know, the interpretation of some data by a computer.
Mm. Well, there was a police department in the United States. They use this predictive policing, and they said that they were able to reduce gun incidents on a particular New Year's Eve by 47%. If there's a means of preventing murder and violence, some will say, why not use it?
Well, I mean, society is not a scientifically controlled experiment, is it? I think that's, you know, I would not take it at the word of a police department that they would. You know, an algorithm reduced murders by 47%. There's so many other factors that come into play. I don't know how you can really claim that. And the problem is, you know, there are ways of reducing violent crime, reducing crime in general in society. And the more functional ways to do that, the ways to do that that are better for everyone and better for society, and not by shoving everyone's data into a giant government computer to try and make some predictions. You know, it's about providing services, providing support, providing education for people.
So you got this information then from the Ministry for Justice using a Freedom of Information instruments. Do we take from that that there was a reluctance to share the information with you or with anybody?
Well, I mean, they published it under Freedom of Information Law, which is a good thing. You know, that is a tool available to anyone. There is also, I mean, there's evidence that the UK government actually keeps track on certain journalists, people who make requests, which is illegal. That's a separate investigation done by another organisation. But, you know, they should be publishing this kind of thing in the first place. We shouldn't have to go looking for it. There should be public registers of research projects into algorithms and into predictive tools. And Ireland should soon have such a thing under the AI Act. There will be like a public database of what they call high-risk AI systems. Unfortunately, there are a lot of exemptions for police authorities and so on. But, you know, it's a step.
And what are your fears around this and around where it might go?
I think there's a risk for individuals who will be affected by this, and that will mainly be people, you know, people who've already been dragged into sort of, you know, had contact with the police, been dragged into the criminal justice system. And that is often people from excluded, marginalized groups, you know, black people, ethnic minorities, and poor people. Individually, the effects for them will be the most, you know, it'll have the most effect, because if you have data that's biased in the first place, the output of these algorithms is going to be biased. Mm-hmm. On a broader social level, I think there's a risk that, and we see this in many, many different spheres. You know, we put faith in technology to solve problems that require social approaches, social and political approaches, and not ones based on technology.
Chris Jones, Executive Director of State Watch, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the Minority Report-inspired project currently underway at the UK Ministry of Justice. Will Tom Cruise be available for the sequel? Margaret spoke to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about the predicament her daughter is in as she prepares to sit the Leaving Cert this summer.
She brought to my attention last year that the adjustment grade, would be dropped this year by 2%. Yeah. And I didn't think anything of it. And then last Friday, a friend said to me, you do realise that there's been a major increase in applications for colleges to the CAO. So there's 6,400 more applicants this year than last year. And then it's said that about 25% of those are people who sat their leave insert in 2023, 24, 22.
Okay, now we have to try and explain it to listeners. Because of COVID and the whole disruption, there was a decision made during COVID to add to the scores that people got in their leaving cert. There was a last year it was, and they're trying to phase it out now. Last year, every person who sat the leaving cert got a 7.5% added to their points, because of the disruption. This year, that figure is now 5.5%, so it's a drop of 2%, and it means anyone who deferred their leaving cert points from last year, when they got the 7.5% boost, in your view, is in a superior and indeed unfair position to anyone sitting their leaving cert this year who will only get a 5.5% boost. That is the dilemma, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just looking at their disadvantage this year. And what I'm looking for is fairness. I'm just looking to see that each student is treated the same. I wrote myself to the Minister of Education on Monday, and I just asked for two options. Either adjust those who are pre-2025 or leave it the same as last year. That's so the two options. It's all I'm looking for is fairness for the students. It's a very stressful time for them.
I know that.
We talk about a Leaving Cert student. It's a Leaving Cert house. The whole house does the leaving.
Good point.
Somebody has to get the food. Somebody has to get the stationery. Mm. Somebody has to do the lifts. Somebody has to. It's everybody.
And everyone else in the house has to curtail their noise, their music, their interference, their whatever. Rightly so, to facilitate the Leaving Cert student. Even though it's not the be-all and end-all, but in Ireland it's such an important exam. And in Ireland, because of the shortage of places, it's supply and demand. And points mean courses, and more points mean you have a better chance of getting in than the person beside you, who might have done as well in the Leaving Cert last year, but they got a 7.5% boost. This year, you did as well as the person sitting beside you last year, but you're only getting a 5.5% boost. Now, what did Helen McEntee reply to you? Well, she looked to her eyes, I presume, but and it's a big issue.
She sent got an acknowledgement, and she said she would get back to me on this. I got an acknowledgement within an hour to say that they would come back to me
on the email
on the
or whatever.
Issue.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, you suggest one of the solutions is those who got the 7.5% bonus last year. You want one of the options is to reduce that bonus.
Yeah, normally just bring it to this year's. Just drop it to the same. So they're just the same. Just even them out. Bring them down. However, I've been reading, the minister has said that they can't do that, and they said that the reason that there's apparently a lawful basis, that is their set grade.
Yeah, this is going to end up in the High Court.
Exactly.
If the minister tried to take 2% off, given that the point system is so tight, if the minister tried to take 2% off, say, somebody who had, 500 points, they'd lose 10 points. That could be the difference between getting on a course and not getting. So if they try to do that to somebody who already has been given their points, that's a straight walk in to the High Court by some family who are upset. And you say the simple solution is keep the 7.5, but do you keep it like COVID is over, thank God? Do you keep this bonus scores in perpetuity?
No. the Leaving Cert has been changed.
Okay.
In the new syllabus, the full new syllabus comes in 2026. So we have a full washout, and we change the thing and change the point so that make it all new, fresh. For the short-term solution here, I think, is leave the 7.5 grade. If there's a legal decision to be made, if legislation has to be changed, bring the changes in 2025-26 so that either next year it's ready, or else keep the same grade, the same inflation of 7.5 until the new syllabus. This could be the difference, Joe, of 60 points.
If you
had somebody that was on the cusp of, we'll say, a H5, and they were on the cusp of that, if they got that 2% inflation, that could give them 10 more points by their six subjects. Now, that's a total different kettle of fish for these kids in a stressful time. And I agree with you, the Leaving is not the be-all and end-all, and the Leaving Cert doesn't suit everyone. But at least let's give us all a fair chance.
Seems reasonable, but where this will go is anyone's guess. Joe's probably right that the courts are going to get involved somewhere along the line. That was Margaret talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about her daughter sitting the Leaving Cert this year. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, a new report from CREE, the heart and stroke charity in Ireland, and Global Heart Hub, reveals that there's an alarming lack of knowledge of symptoms of heart attacks among Irish women, despite heart attacks being among the leading causes of death for women in this country. This morning, Claire Byrne spoke to heart attack survivor Ellie Byrne and to Sarah Early, a consultant cardiothoracic surgeon at St James's Hospital. Claire began with Ellie and her vivid description of not one but two cardiac events.
Back in 2012, I was 48 and was rushing to work. I had an event on that day. Drove to work feeling really unwell. I was working at the University of Limerick at the time. Parked my car, walked towards the building. The building seemed like 10 miles away, even though it was a short walk. And to cut a long story short, a very kindly student noticed that I was struggling, brought me to the St John's ambulance, who happened to be on campus on the day because there were conferrings happening. I was brought into the ambulance. My blood pressure was fine. They said, look, you know, it's probably just stress. Anyway, I started to get tingling in my left hand, my left arm, and I thought, no, this, maybe it's, they've told me in the ambulance that it's fine, so I'm probably good. And my sister-in-law, who was working me at the time, said, why do you keep doing that with your arm? I said, I don't know. She said, look, I need to get you to hospital. And I thought she was overreacting.
Lucky so, you had her watching you, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because I was determined that it was going to be grand. Anyway, I was brought to the regional hospital, and after blood tests, I had had a little heart attack at work, a minor heart attack that was caused by an undetected hole in the heart that I'd had since birth. So it was a congenital thing. Got that fixed. They sent me on my way and said, you're good to go now and you don't need to make any lifestyle changes. I wasn't on medication particularly, just, you know, aspirin. And was going about my business. And 10 years later, almost to the day, actually, I was working from home. I've now run my own little PR company, so I work from home all the time. But my daughter happened to be, she lives in Dublin, but she happened to be home in Kilkee, where we live, also working from home. And she was sitting opposite me at the kitchen table. And I kept kind of wincing and pressing just under my rib cage on my left hand side. And then I was going back to my laptop and working away. And she said to me, Mom, why do you keep doing that wincing thing? I said, I don't know. I've had it for a couple of weeks. I think it's probably just indigestion. And she said, I don't know, Mom, your colour isn't great. And just coincidentally, she had done, and almost unbelievably, she had done a first aid course at work a couple of days prior to that. And one of the topics that came up was heart attack symptoms in women. I mean, it's kind of bizarre. The fact that she was there and that she had just done this course. So she said, have you any other symptoms? I said, well, now that you mention it, I'm getting pain out through my shoulder blades, like a pain in my back and slightly up into my jaw. And she said, oh, my God, Mom, you know, I'm calling an ambulance. Now, this was 2 weeks before Christmas. And I said, Jane, I you're being ridiculous. I don't have time for heart attack. I've all the shopping to do.
Jane,
you know,
you're
the
being
house.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, you're being ridiculous. You know, please, you know, I really think you're overreacting. And she said, no, Mum, I'm calling an ambulance. So I was just mortified. And the two lovely paramedics arrived and I was cleaning the breakfast dishes off the table because I said, you know, the place looks a mess and I'm really embarrassed in front of the paramedics.
So the heart attack has to wait.
Yeah, exactly.
We're getting
exactly.
a good picture of who you are now in all of this.
Listen, you know, but it's women, I think. Not to be anti-men, but I don't think men would have those anxieties. Mm-hmm. It's coming up to Christmas and I don't have the shopping done and I have to, you know, buy
the
presents.
Clean the kitchen for the ambulance
yeah,
crew.
Yeah, I'm cleaning the kitchen for the ambulance crew. And again, as it turns out, I had a major blockage in one of the main arteries in my heart. And subsequently, also, they discovered that I had an aneurysm, a little like a swelling in the aortic artery and a leaky valve. So basically, my heart was, I was on the brink of catastrophe, actually.
You really
Claire.
Were.
And the symptoms had been going on for weeks and weeks and weeks, and I was ignoring them.
So the pain in the ribs going out through the back, those
yeah,
symptoms?
Yeah, well, they were kind of separate pains. The pain in the rib was like indigestion. It was like a tiny, niggly, not significant, tiny, niggly pain. But the pain out through my shoulder blades was kind of severe. But I was putting it down to indigestion or, I don't know, acid reflux or something. But I now subsequently know that they were very, very clear and very obvious signs.
So you owe Jane your life?
Absolutely.
And your sister-in-law?
Absolutely. Two women. And again, I had told my husband, and I love him dearly and he's great, that I was having these symptoms, but he was there every day and he wasn't particularly. Jane just happened to be home that day and had just done this course and was convinced. And she said my colour wasn't good either. So all by way of saying, women need to take notice. Forget about the dishes. Forget about Christmas. If you've got these niggly symptoms, you
well,
really need to get it checked
out. Our consultant, Sarah, beside you, you were nodding along when you heard that Ellie was cleaning up and ignoring the symptoms and worried about the Christmas shopping. And you said that's really common.
So common. It's. I mean, I was saying to the girls recently that I had a patient in, she was 83 and had really similar symptoms. She didn't feel great, bit off, but thought, I've loads to do. I've got to get the farm organised and there's things to be done. So it paid no attention. Exactly the same. Bit of indigestion. She said, maybe I had a bit of a bang, but it sort of settled. And when she finally went to her GP, who said, this isn't... She drove herself to the GP. Obviously, she didn't want to trouble anybody. Drove herself to the GP and the GP said, you have to go to hospital. And she'd had a massive heart attack.
Right. So this is common amongst
so
women.
So common. Like that. I don't have time and I have other things to do. And I think it's because women often have, you know, been through quite a lot, particularly like postmenopausal, and you've had all these symptoms, you're like, oh, it's probably just more of the same. Mm-hmm. So it is really important to think about your heart. It could be your heart and don't ignore it. And if you're developing new symptoms, and 60 is young. So the other thing I'm told all the time is, I'm just getting old. You're not old. Like 60 is not old. 70 isn't really old. And if you're developing new symptoms out of nowhere, you're getting short of breath where you never had been, then you're getting some indigestion, really common things. So what we're saying is just to pay attention.
Right. And maybe that should be the first thing that you think about before you move on to anything else.
Well, like your gallbladder is probably not going to kill you today, but your heart might. So like let's exclude the heart as the problem and then we can move on to your hysteria or your crazy mood or just being mad woman.
Sarah Early, a consultant cardiothoracic surgeon at St. James's Hospital, along with heart attack survivor Ellie Byrne, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the symptoms women need to look out for when it comes to heart health. And that's all I have for you on this summery Thursday edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on the air and in podcast land every Saturday with a brighter, summerier, shinier look back at an entire week in radio. For me, though, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.